see. So it is 7:05. This is the Boulder Town Planning Commission for Thursday, April 8th, 2021. And I think we have all of our commissioners on, and Peg has got a roll call for everybody. So the first thing we're going to do is, can I hear a motion to approve the agenda?
Yeah, I'll make a motion to approve the agenda from, for today. I was thinking minutes. Someone second that?
I'll second it.
All in favor, Matt Cochran, aye.
Haley Apperson, aye.
Yosemite was aye.
Cookie was muted.
I think, yeah, Cookie, you muted. Colleen Thompson, aye. I think she did say aye.
Yes, I did.
Oh, there. Yeah, sorry. Cookie, okay.
Sorry.
You're fine. Okay, so did anyone have any comments about the minutes that they wanted to make before we approve them? Okay, so I'll make a motion to approve the March minutes.
Second that motion. All in favor, Matt Cochran, aye.
Cookie Shallings, aye.
And aye.
Haley Apperson, aye.
I wasn't present, so.
Right. That's right. Night. Thank you, Josie.
Yep.
Actually, I don't think Haley was either, was she? For last?
No, that's right. You're right. Haley wasn't there. So it was just, Matt Cookie and I.
Yes.
Okay, so we.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and move into the Lee Nellis discussion. And we'll be talking about RV park and campground standards and other lodging entities. And we'll go ahead, Lee.
Alrighty, thank you.
Thank you.
Last session, we went over a series of what are pretty specific questions about the RV standards that you have in the ordinance now, and maybe a few small additions to that. And then in the interim, I sent you a brief memo about the idea of developed campsites as it had been included in the work that was done in building a new use table. And I did that because I think they're related. The ordinance provides for you to allow tent sites in RV parks as well as RV sites. And then the developed campsite idea is about tent sites. Trailers are not even permitted the way it is defined right now. And so we have some pretty significant and specific questions. Yes, thank you. And what I would like to do is to switch back to the first memo, the one about the RV standards, if we could, Peg. And there are some specific questions on it. And we could just run through those questions now that people have had a month to consider them. And see what show people think about changes we should make or clarifications in a couple of cases. I'd like to think we can blast through this fairly efficiently. So Peg, can you get the other memo up, the earlier one?
You're not seeing that? The March 11th one?
I see the developed campsites one for April 3rd, but I don't see the and
hold on. I thought I have it up for me, but hold on.
Right.
Okay. Should be coming up here.
Oh yeah.
There it is.
So,
March 11th.
Yep. And I started that more or less, there was a question about whether you guys prefer to use the word developer or the word applicant in the procedural parts of things. The ordinances do both, and we probably ought to shrink that down. I've been shrinking it to applicant, but if anybody wants to use developer instead of applicant, just tell me, and I'll switch them all back. But the substantive question, and in my mind at least, the most important question about RV parks and or campgrounds as you choose them is that the existing ordinance is pretty much structured so that it encourages relatively large RV parks. There's a minimum parcel size of 5 acres. Given the density, that means that what you're saying is it's unlikely that anybody's going to propose an RV park to you with fewer than 25 spaces. And that's a very low density RV park on 5 acres. Even if you double that, you're still going to have a very low lot coverage. But before we talk about the lot coverage and you know, the specific dynamics of it, I was hoping that people had thought through the idea of whether you want to continue that 5 acre minimum, or whether we would either have a smaller minimum or no minimum at all, and look at the actual, you know, appearance and development of the campground rather than a minimum lot size. Because right now, to my mind, a 25 unit campground in Boulder is a pretty big RV park, and maybe it would be more likely that a person could make it work as a business venture, and be more likely to have a smaller impact on the town if you permitted people to have a smaller operation. So that's where I'd like to start the discussion, and then once we've clarified that, there's several other specific questions that we could get through.
Does anybody have any comments?
Well, this is Cookie Shouse speaking, and I think 25 is an awful lot. I started thinking about not having a minimum, and I could be talked out of all this after I hear other people's reasoning on it, but I think it might give us more leeway in considering an applicant's plan for an RV park. I don't know. The other part, well, we'll get to another part of that. But anyway, that's what I think about that, is that 25 RVs are just too many for a 5 acre development.
My only comment too with that, because I was thinking about the same thing, because we talked about just having 10 spaces for RVs and maybe 5 spaces for tent, you know, 8 to 10 spaces. So to go more with how many spaces we want opposed to the acreage that it's sitting on.
Matt here. Yeah, I'm undecided as well. I mean, you look over in Torrey and you see those giant RV parks. And, you know, that doesn't seem like a character fit, at least for Boulder. At the same time, you know, to have multiple 1 acre RV parks would be somewhat, I don't know if that's right. But a lot of these other questions, I think, Lee, play into that thing, which is, I don't know which comes first here.
Right.
You know, if you're requiring that they have to have electric infrastructure, so there's no generators, then there's a certain cost that goes in to developing an RV park. So it has to have a certain density and acreage to make it profitable, I suppose. So at this point, you know, I'd consider somewhat smaller. I don't think 1 acre lots, I think that'd be too small. But there's also this question of, I think you said a standard density for 1 acre was 10 li last time or something like that.
That's kind of the threshold of profitability as okay. the industry standards go, is 10 units per acre.
Right.
And, you know, that just because that's a rule of thumb about profitability doesn't oblige the town of Boulder to use it. And I don't want to say that it does. I just want to try to be in the space of what's real. I don't want us to spend all this energy writing a standard that doesn't allow a person to propose something that might actually work.
Right.
Them, you know, as the applicant. If we're going to have businesses at all, then it's good for them to be successful.
And yeah, so we don't want to write an imaginary ordinance that's not going to work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at the same time, I wonder, you know, how, what was I going to say with, you know, if you increase the density, or here to complicate matters, can you have a maximum amount of RVs in an RV park?
The maximum's no problem. If you want to impose a maximum, we can write that in here.
Because we have not done that, and that might be something we need to consider.
We could do that. I guess, let me ask a question that builds on something you just said, Matt, about, you know, what's the first thing you consider. With the commercial development standards that were just adopted by council, we have a fair amount of power to deal with issues like landscaping and setbacks and the conditions of development. And then we would add some more to that with the other standards here. So, you know, you don't have to imagine an RV park that's just a sea of steel and plastic, aluminum and plastic, I guess. And you imagine one in which, you know, you can require trees, in which you can have some, quite a bit of influence on appearance. My own gut reaction, although it would take a fair amount of work to do this, is that if we were to assemble, you know, photographs of different RV parks around, that we'd find out that it's the trees and the things like that that make the most difference in getting a favorable response rather than the density. I mean, I've seen parks that are really crammed and they would stand out, but if you put 10 RV units down to an acre on a pad that's adequate to accommodate the RV in the pool or you know, a motorhome, you're still not going to be covering half of that acre with, you know, pad sites. So it's not going to be, you know, crammed side by side with very little space between them. And I think that, you know, there, all these factors interact in terms of the appearance. I just think, and I think probably we all agree at some level that there is a maximum size. And, you know, if we said, well, let's set the maximum size at, you know, 20 spaces or something like that, then we could let the parcel size, we could let the applicant work backwards to the parcel size they want to put it on and take a look at the setbacks and the landscaping, evaluate it on the basis of the details that actually make it work and see where we're at, rather than having an arbitrary minimum size. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with an acre or so as a minimum size if you want to put that in. But I think that the goal here is to have, at least the goal as I see it, is to have smaller but attractive RV parks rather than ones that are so large that even if you do some good landscaping and such, they have a big impact. So,
well, I mean, personally, I'm curious what the other PC members think. You know, I'm thinking right now, then it seems like at least a good start would be to increase the density to 10. So there's a threshold of profitability, as you said, someone can actually make a living doing it. And we figure out a maximum, maybe it is 20. I'm not sure what number works for y'all, but that's a good number for me, no matter what the acreage is. And that then promotes smaller scale, perhaps more aesthetic RV campgrounds.
When we talk about the 20 spaces, are we including the little campsites as part of those spaces?
Not that I remember.
I guess I'm confused by the question.
Well, I think Cookie's referring to we're talking right now about RV spaces. But we also are including campsites in that too. So if you had RV spaces and campsites, would it be 10 to 20 RV spaces and then 5 campsites that went along with it? Is that what you're saying, Cookie?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Okay.
Well, another question.
Go ahead, Haley.
Well, along kind of with that is then like, you know, another thing to think about is how big then is each space? Like, is that something, you know, that goes into, you know, does each space have to be a certain size? Like the RV spaces are a certain size, the campsites are a certain size, are they condensed to a certain space on the 20 acres? Are they, how far spread out are they allowed to be? You know, stuff like that.
Could I make a comment?
If
you take a look at Wonderland over in Torrey, you might kind of want to use that as your model. Do you want that many vehicles into that kind of a space? That might give you an example to go by. And we all are familiar with that one.
It has a pretty high density.
Well, so does the one in... where you turn off on Kodachrome, I can't think right now. There's a KOA there. It's fairly dense there. The one in Escalante that's brand new is fairly dense. I think for me, I'm not too concerned about the density as long as if we could push the buffering back so that they weren't right on the road, so that we moved the park back far enough to where the space wasn't so far in the front of the property, because all of these will be off of Highway 12, right?
Right. Yeah, they have to be accessible to Highway 12 according to the standards we've already adopted. So and
so if there's buffering in the front and we make them pull back, you wouldn't really see the 10 or 20 spaces. It would be more acceptable, I think. Does that sound make sense?
Yeah. So, you know, when I'm looking at this, I keep in mind that this original ordinance was written when, you know, these RV parks could be put in different zones and not restricted to Highway 12. So it kind of changes the way I look at the ordinance.
Yeah.
To me, you know, if we have a density per acre and we allow 5 acres, that's a huge park. So I think a maximum is important.
Yeah.
I kind of like the 20 space maximum, and maybe, you know, like Lee said, to leave the acreage up to the applicant. If you have it at 20, if you spread it out, it's kind of less of a visual impact, and to me that's not as important as how many, you know, RVs or the 20 limit on the RVs. That's more important to me. But the other thing I think about is the possibility of restricting how many RV parks within, you know, town limits, because there's a market, right? And if we have multiple RV parks all along Highway 12, I think that's going to be a really significant impact on our, you know, community. And I don't know if that's possible because it's, you know, a commercial venture, but it's something I'd like to think about.
So what do you think, Lee? Those are some of our comments.
Well, the first piece of it that I want to pick back up is the wider buffer. And it would be really easy for us to write that in. You know, the setbacks in the existing ordinance are not very big setbacks. And
right.
You can get an RV, 15 feet from the right-of-way? Excuse me, I think under the existing ordinance, and that's pretty close. And the buffer will obviously also help determine how much acreage is required here, as well as the need to get spaces. And so my sense is that we probably, depending on the number of trees or, you know, other types of vegetation that we can get in there, especially, you know, if it's irrigated, they can do some planting. You know, I'm thinking a 40-foot buffer back from the road would be about right. Perhaps it could even be a little bit deeper than that. But I'd say we start with a minimum of 40 feet from the edge of the right-of-way and add, you know, the requirement that there be some trees, shrubs, whatever, installed there. And that would soften it up a lot. The other thing that is harder to control because it's going to vary by site and with what the applicant wants to do is, you know, the size of the spaces. In this day and age, given the rigs that some people tow around, the applicant's going to want to have pretty big pads to set those things on. We might, although it's awfully hard to write a standard that applies to every case, but you might want to say that the layout of the park should have smaller spaces closer to the road and the behemoth spaces further back. And, you know, the tent sites usually get stuck in a corner. Sometimes they're okay and sometimes they're not so great, but I think the buffer is really important. And then if you want to go with 20 sites max per park, I have, you know, there's no issue with writing that in. It's a little bit arbitrary, but you're going to have to pick a number, so let's pick 20. And then the question came up, the third question and the one that's hardest in some ways to deal with is multiple RV parks. And I think that, you know, there could be, if there was a string of them, you know, there's enough vacant space along Highway 12 that it could be kind of monotonous row of RV parks, I guess, if people found those to be profitable and wanted to install more of them. But I also hate to write an arbitrary number in here. It seems to me that what we would want to go back to is the compatibility with adjoining uses and those broader compatibility standards that we have in the commercial development standards, and be able to use those to say, hey, this is too much. And now that we've, you know, now that you guys have uncorked this particular idea, I think that I can see maybe tinkering with the language of those more general standards would allow you to say, hey, this is overkill. And rather than picking a number, because, you know, if we pick three and then a really nice looking fourth one with 10 units comes in, are you going to feel good about that decision? Maybe not. So
yeah, well, if I might add a comment, Lee, I think what Josie brings up is really important, because especially, and I know things are changing, but in the age of pandemic, what are we seeing? We're seeing, many, many more RVs coming through as opposed to even hotel stays and so on like that. So what do the people of Boulder and PC want? Do you want, if there are three campsites with 20 spaces, that's 60 RVs here a night, on a full night. That's quite an impact on the town. So it's something that I think that's very real and we should consider pretty seriously.
I would agree with Matt. And I just think about, the impact. I mean, I don't think the town could even support that, at this point. And who knows what's to come, but I think it's really important to think about that too. Because you could get a bunch of people in here that just come and put RV parks, and then what about, the places to eat, or the gas to fuel up, or the water, or the, all the other things that have to support that. So I think it's a really important thing to look at as well.
Okay, well, let me fiddle with that idea, and with the bigger buffer and the maximum of 20 units in a park, and write that up for you. And we can come back to it. And then I would suggest that we move on to the rest of the questions here, all of which are a little smaller and simpler. But I just want to make sure that I get your input on the remainder of these questions, if we're okay with moving on from the big question of how many and, how dense.
Yeah, I'm good to go.
Okay. So if you go down onto the next page, if you're following along, you've got the property development standards, item 6A. All designated RV pads shall be clearly marked and numbered for identification. I'm assuming that just means that the park hangs a number on a pole or a post. And I'm not sure we even need to say that, because they're going to do that just to operate their business. But I wanted to make sure that I understood the intent of this before we moved on past that. And then the next
one. I'm sure that's what the intent was.
If there's nothing that I didn't get, then we're good. The next one gets right back to some degree to the question we were just discussing, but in a smaller way. Each RV site shall have adequate space provided, for tenants to park off the park streets. And that's, I guess, to some extent, you can find older, more crowded parks where that may not be true, but anybody who's building a new park is probably going to do that. But it does get us to a place here where we could ask if we want to have a minimum length or depth of spaces so that they are all large enough that people can get both the trailer, if there is one, and the puller onto the pad, or get a whole motorhome on there, which means you're going to have a minimum length of at least 50 feet for those. And some of them are, you can find, I think the KOA standards now have an 85 foot long version.
Wow.
The very biggest.
I suggest we go with moderate standards, whatever those might be out there.
And I would say that we should say there needs to be a minimum length of 50 feet, and that will put most trailers and the puller off the park street. Mine adds up to 40 some feet, and it's certainly not the biggest one out there. I don't know. Well, I think that you don't want to regulate too hard things that the people who set up the park are going to take care of anyway. And then there's the next item down here would be to say the parking pad shall be all weather surface, gravel or better. And then that gets repeated a little later on in here about the roads. And I was just going to combine and say that all the traveled surfaces, roads, pads, whatever, have to be, you know, an all-weather surface, that we're not going to let them park on dirt and generate a lot of dust. So I'm just going to consolidate, if that's okay, a couple of different pieces of the way this was originally written. The maneuvering thing there is, I don't think needs any particular work. And then that item three there, a minimum of 2 common parking spaces for each 10 RV or camping sites shall be provided in the park. They'll be in addition to the required off-street parking. And, you know, our table of required off-street parking doesn't cover RVs and campgrounds. So I think this thing is kind of internally, well, it's internally inconsistent unless I'm missing something in the ordinance somewhere else. And I probably would say that we just eliminate that sentence about it's an addition to the required off-street parking and leave it as 2 spaces for every 10. And that's pretty clear.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're just trying to make this a little bit easier to understand. So then there's some items there, item C on landscaping, which is covered in the commercial development standards that are already adopted. And you've already answered my question for me, which is, I think the answer is yes, you want different buffers for RV parks. You want them set further back from the road, right?
Yeah.
So we've gotten that. At some point in all the landscaping standards, not just about RV parks, we've got to talk about what is acceptable in the way of xeriscapes for places where there's no irrigation. But I don't know that we, and maybe we don't even want to accept xeriscapes where we need a big buffer. Maybe we need to say, hey, if you can't irrigate it and grow some vegetation there, then this is not what we want you to do. I guess that would probably be how I fell down on it. It's really hard to hide RV units with a xeriscape.
It's not very compatible with the commercial standards we've put through, at least.
No, it's not. We've got a lot of landscaping requirements. That item D there on ongoing park maintenance, it occurred to me that we need to write up an overall maintenance standard for any improvements that require for any development. And so that I'm going to propose a replacement, a broader replacement for that, that will do the same thing this was intended to do. Tent sites, no reason to change that unless you think there needs to be a minimum size for tent sites. And then we come back to the idea of screening and buffering in this perimeter screening. And I was trying to decide how screening was different than landscaping in the minds of whoever put this together in the first place. And the only thing I could think of is, were they saying there needs to be a fence or a wall around it? You guys may or may not know what the original intent was here. I will just say that normally asking people to put up fences or walls ends up having adverse consequences. Somebody will come by and paint graffiti on the wall, or it just isn't as effective.
You don't really see very many walls in RV parks. I mean,
no, you don't. You know,
when it comes right down to it, they're pretty open.
Yeah, the
And again, I think the commercial standards sort of make that a moot point.
I think we've got this.
Yeah.
And then here, the next one is about the streets, and I'm just going to combine what it said about all-weather surface for the pads with the streets. There's no need to have two separate standards. And then we get down to the one with the minimum width of traveled surface, which is fine. In an RV park, turning radius gets to be really important. And the radius where they enter the park, since all these have to be accessible to Utah 12, they'll have to have that regulated by UDOT anyway. But we might want to add something about having an adequate radius here internal in the park, as well as having the minimum width. Because that really, that gets to be very important.
That's what takes up your space, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the radius. I mean, if you can't make a perpendicular right or left turn with a large travel trailer or a big motorhome, you just can't do it. So you have to have a fairly gentle radius. These streets all have to curve some. And then there's a minimum of 12 feet for the one-way streets and 24 for two-way. There's nothing wrong with that. Park streets engineered for drainage. We already have a stormwater standard that I think we'll just eliminate this and let the stormwater standard go. Now, the way we wrote the lighting standards that we have so far in the commercial standards, they don't require anybody to light up anything. They just say that if you do, it has to meet a certain standard. So if you want illumination in the park to be a town regulation, we'd have to make that clear. I think that's going to mostly take care of itself. And then we get down to setbacks, and we've already talked about that. Recreation, common open areas for recreation, convenient, accessible. For the smaller parks that we're talking about, they're not going to invest a whole lot in recreational facilities, I don't think. And this didn't actually require it, it just says they're recommended. So in some ways, I'm tempted to just zap that out of there so we don't have a standard that really isn't a standard. But if you think it's important to have some on-site recreation facilities, if it's important enough to require them, then we need to talk about that and make sure that we do require them.
I don't see a need personally. Me either.
You know, if you're in a big KOA with 180 spaces, then yeah, having a miniature golf course or all sorts of things works. But if what we're looking at is a park that has 8 spaces or 10 spaces, then there just isn't any reason for the, nothing will support the investment. Let's put it that way.
What about, this is maybe something that's already answered or I just missed, but like the bathrooms.
We're getting there. Just hang on.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We're not far from there.
But yeah, I'm like, that's kind of a thing.
It's coming right up. So the next one just has a peculiarity. It says each park shall provide a permanent structure for office use. And such building may include a single family dwelling for the use of the park owner or manager. And I wrote in there, my question, the way I wrote it for you was, why can't the office and residence be separate? But by our commercial development standards, they already can. So the person who is either owning or managing this park, there can be a permanent residence with any commercial establishment, right, for employees or owners. So we probably can just take the residential part of that off of there because it's already covered. And then we get down to, and I did not take the time to go look at what the state health requirements are, but I need to. Public restrooms, clean toilet, sinks, and showers shall be provided. according to health requirements. And I'm assuming those are state requirements, probably enforced by the district health.
Yeah, we looked into it a little bit when we were discussing this with the...
I just need to find a more precise reference there.
Yeah.
And then the telephone, I guess that we could say they have to install a public payphone. That seems a little outdated in this day and age.
Yeah, maybe if we're back in the 90s, but we aren't.
Yeah. So I'm thinking we'll just zap that one out of here. Fuel dispensing equipment. This one's, I didn't even put a note on this. I should have. That's a separate commercial use. That's not part of an RV park, and not part of how we would define an RV park. And so if they're going to dispense fuel, then that's going to be a separate part of their application. I guess what we're talking about there probably is propane, right? Rather than that they would be operating as a service station. So, yeah, and a lot of RV parks do have a propane thing, but it would have to comply with the fire code. So in a sense, we have it covered. Now, storage areas is a big, vague idea here. Areas for the storage of vehicles and other items be the responsibility of the park, be controlled. I guess I would say that that's dead storage, okay, of RVs or of anything else is a different use than an RV park.
I agree.
I do too.
Okay. If everybody's in agreement with that, then we'll take this out of there.
Good.
And if they want to propose storage, then you evaluate the storage on its merits. Removal of wheels, we can leave that in there. Generators, it seems to me that if you don't allow generators to be operated, then maybe you just require power drops. You go on down from this one a couple of notches, you get to where it says those RV sites that provide for sewer power and water drops shall meet the requirements of the utilities. And I'm my thought about how to make this work well is just to say that if you're going to have an RV park in Boulder, it has to have sewer power and water.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
I'm in agreement with that.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can go take your trailer out to the BLM and park out there and be dry and independent, and that's okay. But in town, where we do have water service anyway, where they're going to have an on-site wastewater system, I don't think you're actually adding anything that common sense doesn't suggest anyhow. We got to have a dumpster area and have that properly screened and everything. I'm going to rewrite that because what does appropriate actually mean? But I think we need to say that the dumpsters or whatever other trash disposal facilities exist or properly screened and, that. And then we get down to a couple of slightly different questions here that end this. And one of them is the combination of an RV park with an actual like mobile home park or mobile home subdivision. It says they should be kept separate. I guess I would revise that to just say, hey, there are two different uses. There needs to be a separate application. And a park, a mobile home park or a mobile home subdivision in which the tenancy is longer than 180 days that we have down in the next section has to go through the subdivision regulations.
That makes sense.
I agree.
I think we can just simplify and clarify this. And then the tenancy, we talked about that a little bit in our last discussion. And, you know, you can change it, but you've got the 180 days in there now. So there's a usable specific standard, and we don't have to mess with that unless you do want to change it.
That's a long time.
You know, I thought about that, and here's my answer is that RV parks are one way to have workforce housing.
Yeah, that's a season.
Yes, it is. That's true.
And so
that's a good point.
I would argue for leaving it this long, because, you know, I mean, when I was a park ranger, I towed my trailer up, and, you know, the park provided an out of sight, out of the way RV park for employees. And that way the park had to provide less housing. And those of us who liked, you know, to live in our own units could live that way. And we were there, you know, for the duration. I was there for not 180 days, but for more than 90. So I think it works for employees pretty well when you have seasonal businesses. And then, you know, they tow it away, and it's not there occupying space. So I would argue to leave this tenancy period that long, and maybe that helps a little bit with the housing issues.
Right. Yeah, good.
Okay. Let's talk about the developed campsite idea.
Before we move on, I just have two things as you were going through that. I didn't see clarification on the tent spaces, that what would be required for parking for them. And I'm not sure if that was covered up above, but it does. There needs to be something to put the tent space, has to have some kind of a parking requirement.
Parking, right. Okay.
And then as far as the illumination, I think it'd be important to say that it needs to be dark sky compliant, unless that's already covered in our commercial.
Well, we can just leave the commercial standard the way it is, and it'll be covered.
Okay.
And I don't think, I don't see why the town of Boulder would require a park operator to light the park up.
No, we don't want that. I don't think, yeah.
Park operator is going to provide whatever illumination they think is necessary. We're going to check it and see if it meets the dark sky standard, and it seems to me like that's all that needs to happen.
Okay.
So.
And the other thing we talked about, too, Lee, was ground lighting. People are using more ground lighting.
Right. Right. Well, you know, and that, I mean, the way our standard that we adopted is written, it doesn't matter what form of lighting you use as long as it meets the dark sky standard.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So it seems to me that,
yeah,
you know, an awful lot of the RV parks that I have stayed in use ground lighting. It's a practical and relatively easy thing to do from the park operator's point of view, but I don't think the town needs to get involved in what choices they make at that level. We just need to say, hey, you
okay.
can't light up the sky with it. So at this point, I'm wondering if somebody can explain to me the logic of having the separate designated campsites and why that was added.
I'll take a shot at that. And it is because before we had, you know, this commercial limitation to Highway 12, campsites could be anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so we needed to define what that was and what type of, you know, limitations they would have. But if developed campsites are considered commercial and restricted to Highway 12, then it would fall under, in my mind, this RV ordinance.
Well, that's easy.
Anybody see that differently?
Everybody good with that?
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, no, that was the original. Yeah, we are in a different ball game back then.
So now let me ask you a question. I own property in Boulder. I have not yet built a permanent dwelling on it. Am I allowed to camp on it?
Yes, because it's not commercial. That's not a commercial transaction.
And I'm just trying to get the, trying to make sure I understand the logic here so that we have things as well tied together as we can. Okay, then I think we've simplified things greatly with writing those commercial standards, and what we've done with RV parks here can snug into that. And we've used up almost the whole hour we're supposed to devote to this. So we probably ought to stop here. But I'm going to send you, before the next meeting, I'll send you some questions about guest ranches, which was the other part of, these different types of accommodations or lodgings that we've discussed. I'll probably send you a set of questions similar to what I sent you about RV parks.
Okay.
Lee, before we go on to something else, I just want to say that I just think that there should be someone present at the RV park. I would love it if there would be a resident there.
Mm-hmm.
Just because things can happen and there should be someone present. And I know that got kind of jumped over, but I'd like to hear what other people think about that.
That has occurred to me too, but if we're looking at real small RV parks, I thought that might be overkill. One thing that we had discussed, I believe it was on RSTRs, was that, a phone number was posted and the manager had to be able to respond within a certain time. I think that made it into that ordinance, if I remember right. So someone didn't have to be on site all the time, but they needed to respond, I think, within an hour. Is that something we could consider? If you had an RV park with only 5 RVs there, I don't know if having somebody on site would be necessary. That was just my initial thoughts as we were going through this.
Okay. I'll add that in, that there has to be a number posted in a response. I think that my guess is that in a lot of cases, people will conceive of this as a business that they live there at least seasonally, and that you will have something there. But at the scale we're talking about, requiring that would be really hard.
Huh.
So thinking about the sign and the posting, and we'll see if that satisfies that need.
Does anyone have any other input on that, though? I don't want to be the only one to influence that.
Well, I feel like any time that we were camping as kids there's always been a place that you would go and that somebody was there, just like a motel or I know it's a small, I don't know. I'm kind of like Cookie as far as having something happens and somebody can't be there for a whole hour. That's a long time. You have an accident, or I guess, do you just call 911?
You can call 911 if it's a real accident anyway. But
the hard one in this day and age, people can book online and you don't need someone really to show up at all anymore, it seems like. But I hear what Lee's saying about a small campsite, and I don't know if it's enforceable, but I would suggest, and I hear what you're saying, Josie, about, having someone within phone call. But, I wonder if there's a certain number of sites, more than 5, where you need someone. We suggest that you have someone on property.
We could write it that way, too. I just think that we've kind of worked our way around to the idea that people are more comfortable with smaller RV parks. Less impact visually and in other ways. And so we're going to have to figure out what our priority is. And, you know, yeah, if you have a 180 unit park, then requiring somebody to be there makes sense. But for 8 units, I just don't think you can do it. I think you post a phone number and then you assume if there's a real emergency that it's going to go through the 911 system. And if it's the emergency of, hey, there's not enough toilet paper in the restrooms, then that'll work itself out.
I'm sorry, what are the 8 spaces? I thought we were considering 20.
We're considering 20, but I'm thinking that we would accommodate even smaller.
Well, yeah, I don't want to be a jerk about this, but yeah. I've just been in situations that it was very hard to get something under control. It was in an RV park, and there was kind of an uproar, and 911 was called. It took over 45 minutes for them to get there, which is could be possible in our area since we're now down to only 2 paramedics or it's just, I don't know. I just feel like somebody needs to be there and be responsible. Plus, it would also give someone a place to live.
Right. Right.
Anyway.
Well, we
let it go.
We can come back to that. I mean, it's a good point. And I guess that, you know, if you write it that way and it turns out that people are not going to build RV parks because of that, then they don't build RV parks. And, you know, I don't think there's anything in town policy that says specifically that we need RV parks. Unless we come looping back to that as we talk about workforce housing. And I think that's, you know, and then if it's workforce housing, then you're back to the point you just made is, okay, it provides a place for somebody to live who may have another job but is also the, you know, the custodian of the park.
I don't have my
keys. It also occurs to me through this discussion that if it was required to be living on site, then that will further ensure that this is a resident owned business and not an outside developer.
Yeah, I would agree with, I think that having someone there, and I don't know. I mean, can you tell me the minimum again as far as acreage we're talking about? Because yeah, I was getting a little confused too. We're talking about 20 sites, but on what acreage? Or
well,
the maximum
10
acreage?
Sites per acre, so the minimum would end up being 2.
2 acres for 20 spots.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But the 20 spots is a maximum, so
right.
Somebody could propose a smaller park.
Right.
The way we've
okay.
talked about it so far, they could propose a smaller.
Okay. Yeah, I like the idea of, you know, having it be a resident too. I like, you know, I think Josie, that's an important part of the economics in our town here, you know, if someone living here is running it.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and it could be part of a business. I mean, there's certainly the potential if you have a seasonal business and, you know, I don't know what we would imagine. You know, you have a seasonal mountain biking business and you're hiring guides. Well, then maybe the way that you would provide for housing for those guides is RV. You have an RV park that had to meet these standards, but that was owned by, you know, the guide business. So, you know, you could have these standards would apply to, you know, that form of workforce housing. And given the practicalities and the realities, I mean, we're going to get into this more and more about providing housing that people can actually afford. This this could be an important way to make seasonal employees and so on have a better place to live that's affordable as opposed to building for people with workforce incomes in Boulder is not easy.
Well, I think as we've talked about some of these before, this is just a start. We're trying to just get started here. We can always change it. We can always build onto it, but at least it's a start for us.
Right. Okay.
You know,
well, I feel like I have a pretty good sense of where we're at, and I will write it up. And like I said, I will also, I'll get you out a list of questions about guest ranches, because that seems like the other major one of these detailed questions that we're talking about. And I'll try to do something similar with just sending you a list of questions, and we can work over them in May.
Okay. Were you going to say something, Josie?
Nope, that wasn't me.
Okay. I didn't. Okay. That sounds good.
Could I make one comment on that?
Yeah.
What if, say somebody in town, say like me, say we decided to have an RV park on 2 acres that we don't have, but we live up here. I mean, to me, if you're having somebody come in from out of town and build one, I can see living on it. But if you're having someone in town building an RV park, then the option would a better option would be for the phone number or somebody that could take care of a situation like that, that is living in town. Does that make sense? It's something to think about anyway.
Yeah, I agree. Or Judy, even, having, if it's, someone in town or, just requiring for, maybe it's a job for someone, maybe it's the campsite or, the RV park manager that lives there. It's not necessarily the owner, but somebody is there maybe. I mean, I don't know.
Well, if it's in town and somebody gets there in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Then they're going to be there faster than any other response that you're going to have. So I think we could write it in a way that provides for what, was just suggested, which is, hey, I just live down the street, right?
Right.
I'll be there in 5 minutes. That's a very different thing than saying, well, I live in Cedar City, we'll be able to get there. So.
And what about, I don't know, I guess it would be up to the, I don't know how you would write this, but up to the owner as to like, okay, that person's out of town and they're not 5 minutes up the street. So then who's responsible?
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I think you guys have a public hearing. You got to get.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lee, for all your information. And then we'll see you next month on.
Right. And I will get some things out to you. I'll get this written up as best I can. And then I'll get some questions about guest ranches.
Okay. That sounds good. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
You guys have a good one.
You too. Thanks. Okay, so we have been having questions before we actually open the public hearing from the public. And then we are opening the public hearing for statements. Peg is actually putting up what is proposed to be moved out and in as far as this amendment to the residential short-term rental ordinance. And Matt, can you just quickly talk about what we're doing here? Would you mind doing that?
Okay, so the public hearing here is for an amendment to the RSTR ordinance, which we passed in, was it 2019 now?
Yeah.
And at that time, we didn't have all the numbers of the permanent residents in Boulder. And since then, Michela has come up with that. And the reason that is important is because we separated the RSTRs into three zones, upper, lower, and middle Boulder. If you want the details on the geography, I think maybe it's written in the ordinance. And we had decided on a percentage rather than a specific number for equitability.
Right.
What didn't get written into the ordinance was a limit on that. So as the ordinance was written, the 15% would be in relationship to increasing ownership within Boulder, meaning the amount of RSTRs would increase as population increased. And that was not the original intent, as far as I understood it, of the PC. So once we had the specific numbers in, what we've done now is return to a cap limit of RSTRs in each zone. And it's based on the numbers of specific data that Michaela got. And it's based on 15% of the primary owners in each zone, which means that there will be 5 total in lower Boulder, 4 total in middle Boulder, and 4 total in upper Boulder. And I think that's it.
Okay, so I had a question, Matt. We were talking about the date when this started, and I wanted to go back to that too, because at the end of that RSTR that we did, there is a date that it says in the codified edition when we pass that. So is that date applicable at the bottom of that statement or at the bottom of that amendment?
What?
Do you know what I'm, do you understand what I'm saying?
Scroll down to it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it says at the very bottom of page 151 that the ordinance was passed 219. Well, it was 5/2/2019. So that date also, right, needs, I mean, is applicable to what we were doing. Is that right?
Well, it doesn't tie into the percentage. It just says
right,
that's when the ordinance.
But the thing was you wanted it to go from that date that we did the ordinance, right?
Well, I think you might be confusing matters, Colleen. You know,
okay.
the date wasn't related in relation to percentage.
Okay.
We've now changed with no percentage to hard numbers, so the date doesn't
okay.
matter.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's all. I just okay. That sounds good. Okay. So I guess what we'll do now is we'll open up it up to questions from the public if anyone has any questions about what Matt just explained and what we're doing tonight. And Michaela or Peg, will one of you handle the questions? Peg?
I'm looking for any raised hands, and I don't see any.
Okay.
If someone wants to speak, you know, either wave at your camera or just blurt it out here, but this is not the public hearing yet. This is just questions about, right?
Right.
Okay, not seeing any. Okay.
Okay. I feel like I'm just going to give it another second. I don't.
Nope.
Okay. So then what I'm going to do is, can I have a motion to open the public hearing?
Yeah, I'll make a motion to close the general meeting and open a public hearing.
I'll second it.
All in favor, Matt Cochran, aye.
Haley Apperson, aye.
Turkey Schaus, aye.
Josie Mews, aye.
Pauline Thompson, aye. Okay, so now does anyone have any comments on the amendment to the residential short-term rental? This is open to the public for any statements.
Not seeing anything yet.
Okay.
It takes them a while to get to walk up to the microphone. No, not yet.
Okay. I'm trying to give them at least a minute or so.
Let's see, I've not been paying attention to chat. Oh, Elizabeth.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and make a comment if no one else is.
Who is that?
This is Donna Owen.
Donna, okay, thank you.
I'm just going to make a comment that I've made in the past that I think that the division of Boulder into three zones is arbitrary, and it isn't something we have actually made legal. And so I think this is really arbitrary, and I don't really like it, and that's just my comment.
Okay. Okay, thank you for your comment. Is there anyone else?
Yeah, Corla Equinta.
Okay, go ahead.
So when you guys issue these permits, are they forever? Are they limited in time? How is that done? What, you know, like if say somebody could just monopolize that business, maybe somebody else wants to do that as well. Is there limits to these, the way this is doled out, if you will?
If I'm not mistaken, I think they come up every year. And if we haven't got to that year point. Curtis did comment, I can't remember, last month or the month before that there had been no other applications made for RSTRs. The two that we do have, like I said, I think it was five. I think next month we could come up and take a look at those again. I don't think we've had any problems with them. So if I'm not mistaken, I think that's what it is. Does anybody else have any comments on that, on the committee?
Yeah, my clarification, Corla, is that it's first come, first serve, but you can't, if you aren't actively using such a conditional use permit after a year, then you lose your ability to hold on to it.
Thank you.
And I would like to put that on, I mean, I don't know if we want to put that on the agenda, but it is 519 that we, next month that we issued though, I think they were within a month of each other. And maybe Curtis can respond to that when we get there, but I think he kind of, does anybody remember that?
I don't remember the exact date, but you're correct. There are two current. I was just going to ask, I don't know that there's anything in the language that says if it's not active, but it does need to be renewed annually, like a business license is my understanding. Yeah. But I don't remember anything specifically about, you know, pursuing it actively. As long as you've got it, then you've got it.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
Well, right here on the shared page, any CUP that is allowed to lapse shall be placed at the back of the wait list, if any, in the next applicant in line. Is that?
Okay. Yeah, if you let it go, but if you were to renew it annually, like you're supposed to, then you're kind of locked in until you choose to let it go, right?
Yeah. And like I said, we can put that out on the agenda and take a look at it next month too, just to if look at it, because I had thought about that too. I knew it was coming up, and we can have Curtis remark on it again too next month, or you. So are there any other comments?
I'm not seeing any more hands raised. Anyone else want to just chime in?
There's a chat question, I think.
Yeah, Phoenix is asking a chat question.
Okay. I have a question. I did not get a chance to read the ordinance, but is there a distinction made between a whole house rental or a rental of a room in a house? Is each permit for any number of rooms for rental?
I'm going to ask that, Phoenix, that you read that, because it is defined in rooms, and it's, you know, as far as that goes, it's like four pages. And so there is definitions, those definitions in it, if you have a chance to read it. And if you want, I can get you a copy of it.
Sure. Yeah, I was just looking for the documents right before the meeting, and I couldn't find them online. So
they're listed on our website under ordinances, and it's towards the bottom of the page, and it'll say the ordinance number, and then off to the right it will say RSTR next to it to give you a little helpful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if you need any help any farther, Phoenix, just let me know, because I do have mine on paper.
Thanks, Colleen.
Any other comments? Okay, so I think I'm going to go ahead and close the comment section. Do I have a motion to close the public hearing?
I'll make a motion to close public hearing, reopen the normal meeting.
I second that. Cookie Schaus.
Thank you, Cookie.
All in favor, Matt.
All
Cox,
in favor.
Matt. Haley Apperson, aye.
Cookie Schaus, aye.
Josie News, aye.
Colleen Thompson, aye. Okay, so then what we're going to do then is go ahead and vote on adding or change. Matt, will you go ahead and form that question? You're so much better.
I'd like to make a motion to amend the RSTR ordinance with what as is written here on the shared page and pass it on to the TC.
I second that.
All in favor, Matt Cochran, aye.
All in favor.
Haley Apperson, aye.
Cookie Schaus, aye.
Joseph Muse, aye.
Colleen Thompson, aye. Okay, great. Thank you, Matt, for that work. And that was a good eye on that, and for following through on that. So the next thing we're going to do is Curtis available? So we're going to hear a concept plan for subdivision from Ray Nelson. Is Curtis speaking on that?
No, Michela.
Oh, Michela, sorry.
I didn't know I was going to present it though.
Oh, here it is.
Well, you could just have Ray go through it.
That would probably be best.
Okay. I think I know that Ray is still here. So Ray, if you're still there, will you let us know what you're doing?
Yes, I will.
Matt,
can you hear
Ray.
Me? Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to go through this page by page or if you just want me to explain what it is I want to do.
I think we just need to have you go ahead.
Okay. Why don't we just, if we can, I'll just explain to you what it is I want to do here. And I'd like to start out, if you can bring up the aerial photo that's in that package.
I'm looking for how to minimize this so I can fit more on the screen. Not sure how to do that.
Well, it's up at the top where you see that 139%.
Oh, thank you.
Hit, hit your drop. There you go.
Okay. That helps.
Okay. I think you're all familiar with where I live. My property is across the road from Hills and Hollows and just up the road a ways. What you see there in the yellow outline is the property that I want to subdivide off. And it's approximately, it's probably just a little under 10 acres. So it's that area in the yellow. And my driveway is over on the right-hand side. It comes in, and of course there's conines, and then it comes on out into the field. And you can see my house in the area that I've watered out there, irrigated. So basically what I want to do is just cut that portion out and subdivide it. And if you go back to that first drawing you had, I can give you a little more detail on the dimensions of the property. No, the one with the red markings on it. Those are just general plat maps. There you go. And if you can reduce that in size a little bit, Peg. A little bit more. There you go. Okay. You can see where I've got 405.94 feet along the state highway. And that leaves my driveway with a 40-foot wide driveway. There you go. And then where you see the dashed line, that's an irrigation line that runs out through my field that I use. And so I brought the property line for the subdivision 40 feet off of that so that I have access to my own water line there. And it runs to the south end of the property, which is the narrow end at the bottom on the right-hand side. Okay, and that distance is from the highway is 1,234.5 feet. That is just a little bit out of your 3-to-1 ratio by about 16 and a half feet. So if you wanted to stick with the 3-to-1 ratio, I could set that last boundary line back 20 feet from my property boundary. And then you would meet the 3-to-1 ratio. So that's basically what I'm trying to do. I can entertain questions. I think I've completed everything that's required. I didn't put a name on it. I'd like to call it Balancing Rock Subdivision. And I don't know if you want to go into discussion on utilities or not at this point. It wasn't part of the requirement, but I can discuss them if you want.
Anyone have any comments?
Yeah, this is Josie. So the 3-to-1 ratio, I mean, that's a really hard one because, you know, setting that back yourself boundary 20 feet is odd, right? And you just have this little strip there.
Well,
but if you,
right.
If you went to the widest point of that lot, which is, I'm going to say probably 40 feet in, where, you know, it's the very top west point, I think you're hitting that ratio there. And so that comes down to interpretation. So I just thought I'd put that out.
Oh, okay. Well,
that makes sense to everybody.
Yeah.
I would prefer to leave it all the way down to the boundary line, but if you, however you want to interpret it, I can do whatever you want on that.
I mean, because the point of that 1-to-3 is not to have these, you know, odd-shaped lots, real long, skinny lots, but when you look at this and you think, well, a little 20-foot strip's odd. And
yeah.
So, you know, I guess it's just a hard one up for discussion. I guess from my point, taking that widest from the furthest point west and measuring the widest down, we might be okay. But on the other hand, it might be an average across that whole thing, because then it starts to get narrow. So I'm just throwing that out there for the Planning Commission.
Yeah, and I suppose I would agree. I mean, mainly 1-3 or whatever that ratio is, just to provide, you know, appropriate access and setback and all that sort of stuff, I imagine. So, yeah, it seems like you'd create more problem with the 20-foot strip off the back down the road.
Right.
Funny, I think because I know this property and I know what Ray's talking about as far as having his water line come down and why he's taken that, why he's done it that way. Like, there's kind of, he does have a reason for making it that way. And so do we take that into consideration? I mean, there's a reason why that it's cut that way. And I'm just asking the question. Because we're just talking about this right now. So I do get the water line and why he's laid it out this way. So that's my only comment, really.
Well, and then that brings up a question. Would this be considered a need for a variance? So we would need to ask that.
Yeah.
Or is it not? If we look at it and we see that the widest point is within the 1-3, does that, suffice being compliant with the ordinance or not?
Right. Right. And Ray, you're just going to sell this as a whole piece, right?
Correct.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead, Colleen.
So will this have water with it?
I have a water right that I will supply with it.
Okay. Okay. Does anyone else have any questions? No questions? And Ms. Shayla, do you have any comments on that? Do you want to go through the application? Do you have the application?
Yeah, I have the application, and Curtis and I have gone through it, and we did talk about the 1-3 ratio. So I think that's just probably something that I need to talk to him about again.
Okay.
Basically, I just wanted to see what happened at tonight's meeting, how the members felt about that. So, and there's some good comments being made, some good points.
Okay. Okay, so does anyone else have any comments? So we'll just, Ms. Shayla, we'll just go from there then, right? Those are our comments.
Okay, great.
And then, that sounds good. Did you have any other comments, Ray?
Yeah, my question is, okay, where does it go from here? You guys discussed the boundaries, the 3-1 ratio, and then you either say yes or no, and you let me know?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll forward this to Curtis, let him know what came up. I'm still kind of learning this whole process, and we'll go from there.
All right.
Okay.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Ray.
Uh-huh.
Ms. Shayla, can I ask a question about
this? Of course.
So you're going to talk to Curtis about the 3-1 and get some sort of decision on that. And in the meantime, Ray holds off on any of the engineering that needs for a preliminary application. Is that?
I would say so, yes. I'll email Curtis either right after this meeting or first thing in the morning with, this question. And so we can get moving forward as quickly as possible.
Okay. Because I'm wondering if it's possible that Ray, you've already talked to an engineer, right? And you've done
I've talked to Rod. He does most of the surveying around here.
Yeah.
And his only comment was the same thing, was the 3-1 ratio with the little tiny piece on the end. And he basically said that it's up to the town to decide. I'd go whatever way the town wants to.
Okay. Well, I guess it's within sort of feasibility that you might have a preliminary application complete in time for the next meeting, but just be aware that I need to send out notifications to all the property owners within 300 feet. So I need time to get the information from you and then notify people and have them have time to be notified. So I'm just saying, if you got everything moving right now, you might have a preliminary application that could be heard in May, but maybe it would be June.
Okay.
Okay.
So I just need to move forward on it.
Yeah.
Okay. No problem.
And that'll just, you're moving forward will be dependent on what Michelle and Curtis have to say about the 3-to-1 thing.
Yeah. It'll just either change the shape or leave it the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And okay. I'll copy you that on that. I'll CC you, Ray, on that email.
Okay. Okay. Great.
So I'm going to make a comment to Corla's comment. The only commercial property that we have in Boulder is commercial property that's already been, so to answer your question, no, this has nothing to do with commercial property. That's not right what Ray's looking at. So I hope that answers your question.
It does, Colleen. Thank you. Yeah, because everybody's talking about commercial has to be on Highway 12. So I just wasn't sure. I thought I remembered that there was a limit to what was already there or something. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's go ahead and we'll move on to the CUP revisions. And Michelle, will you comment on that? I think we're just going to move past this, right?
I better comment on this because I'm responsible for putting this on the agenda.
Okay. Yeah.
It was actually there were some revisions that have already been noted on Lee's documents as we've moved forward on that need to be made to the whole conditional use process. So there will be amendments to that whole Chapter 8, rather significant amendments to how conditional uses are handled. And the part that Curtis had, I was mistaken. He never submitted any kind of a draft. He simply sent an email that said, while you're doing this, Lee, be sure to consider adding those same words we have in the subdivision requirement of notifying property owners within 300 feet of the application for conditional use. And there was a second item along those lines. I'm not remembering offhand, but that's Curtis's input to that whole process. And I think that's a larger discussion than you could probably have tonight. So
Right. So we can put that on next month's agenda. Put it on next month's agenda?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, that sounds good. Okay, so we'll discuss upcoming business for May 13th. So Lee will be back on for campsites for the RV and campground standards.
And guest ranch.
Yeah, and guest ranch, right? So we talked about that. And then we'll have Ray. Now, Ray will be back on the agenda. And that's it for right now, right?
I'm still looking for Sean Owen to have his completed preliminary application for Deer Ranch.
And do you know anything more about that, Michelle?
I talked with John yesterday, and I think there's some confusion about what needs to happen, so I need to relook at. I was looking at the email that Curtis sent to Sean in response to all the stuff that we've received. So I just need to get on the phone with him and double check everything, because it seems like they think everything has been turned in.
Right.
And you know, when Curtis and Peg and I went through it, that wasn't the case. So I just need to clarify that with them. And I talked to John at Hills and Hollows, and it looks like he's going to be assisting Sean through the process. So at least I can get in touch with him about it if I can't get a hold of Sean right away.
Okay, that sounds good. So we might potentially have them back on next month.
I would assume so, yes.
Yeah, and I know there's been a lot of confusion, so, but hopefully it all works out. Thank you. Thank you. Does anybody have any comments for upcoming business that we might have missed, or does that sound good? Okay, it doesn't sound like we have any comments on the upcoming business, so we'll just keep it at what we have. And then we will open it up for a few minutes for final public comments.
This is Cookie Shouse. Can I say something, just public comment?
Sure.
Okay. I just wanted to ask Donna Owen if she would mind sending maybe a letter to planning or something, if she can think of a better way of dividing up Boulder. We did the best we could on that, but if she has any positive comments along those lines about how we could better represent what we were doing, she's certainly welcome to send us an email or whatever.
On what? A comment on what? Did I miss?
Well, she said she didn't, she really did not like the way Boulder was divided into three, and that it was arbitrary, and I can't remember exactly what she said, but if she's
and
got a
not
better
legal.
Idea.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That's all I had to say. If she wants to submit anything along those lines, suggestions, that would be great.
Okay. Does anyone else have any public, do we have any other comments?
Not seen any yet. I actually have one, but I'll be at the end if there's somebody else here. I'm not seeing anybody else waving their hand, but does someone want to chime in just voice-wise? Anybody? No voices. Okay.
So
well,
what's your comment?
My comment is, remember I sent you guys an email regarding the multitudinous land use, LUDMA, those kind of changes that came up in the legislature this year. And there are several things that will affect us. And Colleen, you had suggested putting some of those items on the agenda to talk about, where we actually do have to make changes to our ordinance. I think in the bulk of the land use situations, specifically the use of ADUs, I think we have until October, there's some way of making your changes. But what I would like all of you to know right now is that May 5th, I'm pretty sure is the date, by May 5th, there's going to be a lot of changes to the open meetings and notification requirements. And the biggest thing you guys might notice is that after May 5th, there's no requirement whatsoever for any newspaper notification of any public hearings there's a long list of things that you don't have to publish in the newspaper anymore. So I just want people to be aware of that online getting connected to that Utah Public Meeting Notice Board, that's where everything's going. So you subscribe to that and it gets pushed to your email address, any notices of any meetings you want to hear about. Then of course, our own local stuff, but there will be no more, I guess anyone has the option of putting stuff in the paper, but there will be no more legal requirement to do so. And that includes election information and ballot information, and there's just a huge long list of no longer to be published in newspapers. So I want you to be aware of that.
Okay. And can you get that information to us?
Well, yes.
Or do you
the bill, I think it's a Senate Bill 201. I can send you the link to it, but it's it's 100 pages long.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Utah League of Cities and Towns had put out, that's one of these Wednesday
seminars that they have at noontime that I strongly recommend anyone who's able to tune into those and listen. It's an hour long thereabouts. Well, actually that one was they're an hour to 2 hours actually, but you do get a chance to ask questions and they do try to summarize the bills, but to find out all of the details, I think Lee will also have to help us with some of this stuff. You just have to read the ordinance and see where our ordinances don't match the state's.
Wow. Okay, so so can you send us the link then, or have you?
I have, but I'll do it again. Yeah.
Could you just send us out again? So in case I don't think I can't remember if I got rid of it, but if you could send us all out that link again, that would be great. That's all I need then.
I will.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So do we have any more comments?
Anyone? There are no raised hands. Anyone verbally want to say anything? Nope.
Okay, so I will make a motion that we close our meeting of April 8th Planning Commission meeting. Do I have a second?
I'll second that. All in favor, Matt Cochran, aye.
Cookie Shouts, aye.
Haley Apperson, aye.
Josie Muse, aye.
Pauline Thompson, aye. Thank you, everybody. It was a good meeting. I think we got a lot done. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Yep. That's my life. Good night.